Good evening.
Good evening.
I thought that tonight we're going to discuss the mantra section of the book and kind of wind the whole subject up, at least in this little initial study we're going through. But I just was curious if people had read the contents of the book. I know it's not posted, is it? So...
Emily sent us the assignment by email.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so, but I did think that it was helpful to just, in order to understand, rather just launching into this mantra, which is kind of like the ultimate essence of what we've been exploring for the last how many weeks?
This is class 7.
Yeah, 7 weeks, or 6 weeks previous. This is to just recover. Last week we were sort of reaching the summarization, as it were, or the overview of what we were going through. I thought it would be helpful to sort of look at that again before just starting to talk about the mantra. Does that sound okay?
Yes.
So I think I suggested we start with that last section, starting arriving at dwelling nowhere. So far, is everybody okay about that term, or is that still confusing, the notion of dwelling nowhere, arriving at nowhere?
Could you explain that?
Sariputra! All right, thus he spoke.
Well, so we are looking at the notion, or at least the possibility of going beyond somewhere. Meaning, somewhere is a thing that we impose on a name, a place, a situation, a reference point. We've been labeling everything all of our lives, and we've been imposed with labels from everybody else. We're labeling each other continuously. We're labeling the world. We're slapping posters and announcements on the world. This is this, you're that, you're that, you're that, right? And so we have been learning how to sort of see through that and realize this is kind of like fundamentally a state of delusion. Because basically what's really there is beyond the mind, beyond conceptual mind, beyond our normal kind of whirring, discursive, continuously grasping mind. That makes sense. And so nowhere is actually no problem. It doesn't mean we're lost. It actually means we've, in some sense, found where we are by nowhere. Okay?
So without the reference points or the label?
Yeah, we're letting go of reference points. That's, in a word, that's what it's about. The issue of delusion is really important. He translates this, having fully translated delusion, transcended delusion, we attain complete nirvana. So, does anybody have an understanding or a confusion about this, or a particular take that they wanted to submit to the class?
For me, what's just jumping in on this, it's very, very hard to understand that concept of going beyond delusion. So, that's a long, long way.
Well, we have to discover what delusion is first. I mean, that's the issue. It's not going beyond delusion until we know we are deluded. So, I think that's the path, fundamentally.
Okay.
When we're exploring from the very beginning, realizing the Four Noble Truths are all built around fundamentally being misguided and bewildered by believing in some kind of solidity about ourselves and our experience in the world around us, the notion of permanence and the notion of anticipating the continuation of everything as we are projecting it, because we've been assuming it's all going to happen like it has been happening. and then the rug gets pulled out from under us continuously. And then after a while, we begin to realize there's no rug.
There's no floor.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're just sort of in a free fall. Mm-hmm. And that's actually really, even though a cause for potential concern, as it were, it's actually fundamental freedom. And the question is whether we can really decide that's a good, a sign of positive value.
Well, just brought to mind, if I may say, the quote from Chicken Crimper, which I'm going to botch a little bit, but it's as though you've been thrown from a plane and you get told that the bad news is that you don't have a parachute, but the good news is there's no ground.
Yeah.
So that goes all the way through these teachings, and we're learning how to trust our just the nature of experience itself as we get more open. So one of the things we want to understand about emptiness as we discuss this is that it really has everything to do with openness. Mm-hmm. It's a complete open dimension. Boundless. It doesn't have any boundaries. But if we have to look for some kind of a sense of equivalent, and I don't mean this in a physical, strictly physical sense, but in a sense of how we could understand, the word space is helpful. Space, spacious. When we're spacious, we can accommodate. We are flexible. We can make room and adjust easily, because we're not fixed, we're not fixated, and we're open. And so that spaciousness gives the possibility of a lot more insight into what we're doing here.
It makes me think of Ikebana, flower arranging, that in fact, it's not so much about the pieces that are defining the space, but because they set up a relationship with space, you really see the space around it. So the figure ground, I think, is really an interesting point, you know, that we're always focused on the solidification of our world, and we don't actually see the space around things. So that's that's one thing that helps me a little bit. I mean, it's still very dualistic that way to see it, I suppose.
Actually, I think it's a good start to just reverse the notion of form as defined by some kind of figure, mm-hmm. and recognize that actually what gives rise to that form is space itself. But as we go further into this inquiry and explore further, we can begin to sort of see how this space actually penetrates form itself. That form itself is also space. And of course, we can understand this more and more nowadays with things like particle physics, and where we start to get a much more intimate sense of, and I don't mean this intellectually or conceptually alone, although that can help us perhaps grasp on some outer level, but on some level, as we open up more, it's more of an experiential thing of space, is this kind of unimpeded openness. And so the world, which seems so solid, starts to get much more, as it were, transparent. And then we begin to realize, when we talk about illusion, that illusion is not a problem. Illusion is simply the transitoriness of everything, how everything is impermanent, appearing as it is in a moment, given moment, and appearances continue to appear endlessly, as far as we can tell. But, you know, there's a sense of being open to that. And the delusion, to go back to this term, is thinking that it's not, it's fixed, you know, there's something final about it.
Yeah. But another metaphor he used in here that helped me was the idea of thinking about, like, when you have a dream, when you're in the dream, if you're not, I guess there's this lucid dreaming where you're aware you're dreaming, which I don't ever have, but I'm always like in the dream, it's really happening, whatever happens is very solid to me. And you wake up and you realize that was just your brain going and going and going, and if you sort of notice it, you can realize a lot of times during the day, like what you're thinking is happening is just your brain telling stories about what's going on around you. You don't really know what's happening, you know, with other people or anything. It's just the stories you're telling yourself, whether you're awake or asleep. they're just stories. They're not like that's really what's happening. And I, you know, my sense is often no one knows what's really happening, even for themselves.
Well, so this is interesting also because as your own storylines and continuous stories of whatever they are, my, you, mine, yours, anybody else's, starts to thin out or get more transparent, we begin to realize that, you know, this thing that we don't know about is actually simply present. And so if we are present to the presence, it's actually enough. And so there's a really interesting term that comes up here on page 155 for those of you who have the book, omniscience. You know, Buddhas are called omniscient, and oftentimes this is a real source of confusion because it doesn't mean they know every single thing that's going on everywhere and all the details of the most complex element or factor of nature or mechanics or anything else. Unfortunately, sometimes students tend to believe that the gurus are supposed to have that kind of information. They want to go to them for every, how do I fix my car? How do I fix my love life? How do I take care of, you know, it's like as though somehow omniscience is supposed to basically hand you on a nice little platter an answer to all your concerns.
Well, Emily's recording our minds.
So omniscience, as he describes it here, is pretty good because it actually helps, it helps understand what it is and what it isn't. He's describing it as extended awakened mind towards all phenomena. And so instead of mind being like a tight fist, it's now unfurling. And so basically we're opening up to direct insight and perception of the nature of phenomena. This is called natural emptiness. So in other words, omniscience is not simply having a huge book with all the information of everything you'd ever want to know about anything at all at any time, but it's about simply the capacity to relate properly to any given moment, situation, circumstance, in the sense that that this openness, this fundamental openness, this open dimension of being is actually and fundamentally intelligent. Now, and it's more than intelligent, but intelligent is already good. It's also fundamentally nature of wisdom itself, natural, innate wisdom. So this is where this gets so interesting. You know, it's not like we're just stripping away. We do strip away, and it can get pretty barren, actually, sometimes. But that's part of what we have to learn how we're giving up. What we're giving up is stripping away all of these constant projections and storylines and actually opening up to something else, which we don't know yet is there. I mean, we don't know, but, you know, as we become more open, it becomes a source of, as it were, information or communication.
What would you say would be an example of working with that openness in daily life? How would I experience that? Or maybe other people have experience of what that means. I just wonder about the actual kind of touching into that.
If for a moment, just a moment, you really don't know what's going to happen. Like you haven't, whatever the situation is, like you're in some situation and you just, instead of like, oh, what we usually do, think, oh, this is what's going to happen next. Like you just,
Just waiting, looking and waiting.
Well, waiting can be very powerful, actually. I mean, the capacity to be content with not knowing and a willingness to actually let situations speak to you.
I just thought it's easier with animals, with certain, like, turtles. I was just thinking, for instance, I work at a nature center. And so usually if you're in a relationship with a person and you already have these ideas, what are they going to say next? You worry about it, you think about it, whatever. But if you're just looking at a turtle on a rock, you may have less invested in exactly what they're going to do next. And then there aren't that many options of usually what they do next. It's easy, but...
And you don't say...
How could he do that? So something like that, I think, is a little bit easier.
You're saying there's not a big expectation.
Probably.
Yeah, so you're witnessing more than you're anticipating.
Yeah. Yeah. Your ego's not in there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you're more with what's happening.
Don't you think travel that sort of puts you in that space automatically?
Yes. You really don't know what's going to happen.
Even if you have plans, you're sort of, you don't know all the corners and the place where the shops are and so on and so forth. You're kind of an automatic openness, more spacious.
So we have to learn how to be simple. We even have to learn how to be stupid. You know, I mean, I actually know a guy who's extremely smart. He's so smart, he's just endlessly smart. If he came in here, he'd just completely blow you over with his incredible brains. He's a scientist, and, you know, he's got this fantastic mind, and he's funny, and he's tremendously inventive.
He's talking about my son.
The best instruction he ever got from a teacher was from Tinley Norbu. His name was Andre. And he went up and out and was talking to him, and Timmy Norbert looked at him and said, "Be stupid, Andre." You know? And he felt like that was the most profound instructions he ever received for his practice. So,
I was going to say, where does trust come into this scenario?
Trust? Yeah, that's exactly it. So, trust is coming in. It's actually in our familiarization with openness, with the unknown, with a willingness to suspend either belief or disbelief, to avoid those kind of extremes. Because they actually, at some point in our practice, we can begin to see how they are extremes, grasping, accepting, and rejecting. And you're here. And, you know, this is so simple. We just can't believe anything is this simple. It's so intimate, it's so close that, you know, we refuse to acknowledge anything can just be that way. And I think the trust comes from as we build, and we have to have some faith in, you know, our own Buddha nature. This is, of course, why as we study Dharma, we don't simply continue reading and forgetting about it. I mean, the idea is we want to learn how to engage with this. We learn, first of all, through our meditation practice, and we also are studying the Dharma and learning about how our mind works and this is something we confirm. We need to be able to confirm. We need to find confirming evidence in our experience. And then, at a certain point, you know, we decide if we choose to pursue this further, to take refuge. Taking refuge means really trusting in the nature of your own fundamental Buddha nature. You know, I mean, for some people, it could be as simple as just saying, I believe this historical person was really true, and a perfect example of what I want to be for myself, and I would like to see how the world were. You know, I mean, that's one aspect, but then the other aspect fundamentally is we all have this Buddha nature. It's all inherent in us. It is our own potential. And so having faith in that potential is where we build this trust. And at times it can require a lot of bravery. And, you know, you feel like circumstances are very formidably antagonistic. And we have to learn how to be there with it, you know. And of course, the teachings which we're working with right now helps us, rather than trying to reject or renounce everything and say, I'm through with the world, too much, you know. We're actually willing to be there and actually be open to it. So that then somehow we can find a way to go on. But, you know, there's going to be narrow passages in our experience. It's not all immediately just going to open up wonderfully wide. Even in those narrow experiences, there is the possibility of discovering space. Mm. And we're training and learn how to be flexible so we can actually, you know, ooze through this kind of more challenging, narrow passage. We're just being frank about the fact that life is not just we know it's not just a bowl of cherries. There are going to be periods when, whether it's an illness or whether it's a sense of being deprived or frustrated because the simplest matters aren't working out, that we can actually be there with it and fundamentally endure, as it were, this and learn from it. So Does that help at all?
Yeah.
Because this is, I speak for myself here, frankly. This is not just a theoretical notion I'm espousing.
Can I ask another question? Do you mean in terms of trust, sort of trust that things are going to end up the way you want them to be? Or
no.
What do you mean by trust?
I don't hang on to that much.
Yeah, of course. But I'm wondering what you do mean then.
Trusting in the... that there's a... not in the way that I want it to go, but in an energetic sort of openness, in an energetic sort of flow, that if I am open and spacious, that energy will flow better for me. I don't know if it's a payoff, but maybe, I don't know if that's the right way to look at it. But it feels as if I'm open to things, then things don't feel as tight, and then there's flow. And trusting that through all of that, that there is, something's going to open up. Maybe that's what it is. It's trusting
that things
will open.
Is it a release from anxiety?
No, it's not as simple as anxiety. Mm-hmm. I have to think about it for a second.
Mm-hmm. But I think when we meditate, when we practice meditation, one of the things we're doing is practicing alignment. Mm-hmm. What does this mean? You know, I mean, there's a lot of different ways of describing mm-hmm. what alignment is. But if we are actually establishing a good posture, and posture is so critical for proper meditation, that because it helps us. Our physical alignment helps our brain and the rest of our whole nervous system operate at an optimal situation, optimally best, frankly. It's like, it's not all we have to do by any means, but this kind of tuning in, as it were, is tuning in and actually establishing a relationship, a hierarchy of what is best for us, and establishing a connectivity with the present moment as it is. So the posture helps to support that kind of openness. And that's why it's emphasized again and again. So, sometimes just taking, stopping and doing your posture. So standing, sitting, establishing a really good posture of head and shoulders really helps. Slashing into the moment where we're just sort of like, you know, hitting something that's really hard and we just be there. And somehow that being there sort of opens the curtains on some level to give us a little more room. I wouldn't say payoff. There are moments when you feel payoff comes, when you practice meditation for a while and you've really been reasonably diligent and you've been working on it and working on yourself, and then at a certain point you'll hit something where you do feel like, oh, okay, you know, it won't last. But it's very good when it happens. We absolutely do not want to hang on to those moments. That's really, then it gets bad. But we do want to be able to appreciate it when it happens. So we can appreciate it and then move forward. You know, we're just present, going forward. Everything is continuously in a state of this flux of change. Fine. But those moments are helpful. And so the alignment, the notion of alignment, for me has been very helpful. I had another guy tell me, who's a Zen master, a friend of mine in Boulder, who basically taught, he just used this word alignment, and it just made complete sense with regard to posture and heaven and earth, as we say in Shambhala language, you know, the notion of there's this vast space and earth is simply being right here, nowhere to go, and we want them to meet. You know, we want them to join, and we have to be the ones to join it. It's not going to just happen automatically. I mean, this is why we are different from animals, as it were. Because we have the capacity to make these kind of choices. So this is what we do. If we exercise this choice, then it's easier to do the next time.
Because you're laying down a track of memory that actually,
momentum.
The momentum, yeah, the more you do it, the more you remember.
The momentum, and it's easier. Even when we get really out there and get completely you know, like, oh my God, how did I get here? You know, all right, you know, I mean, we can come back. So that's why the training in meditation is so critical. So, he's describing this finally as realization, as being fundamentally experience of emptiness just as is, beyond and opposed to something realized by somebody or something. Is that worth exploring for a minute? Do we understand that?
Would you say that again? I'm going to just repeat that.
It's emptiness, openness just as it is, as opposed to something realized by somebody or something.
Well, that phrase, as it is really a key phrase, right? Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
It's just as it is.
We're talking simply about surrendering, and we're surrendering more and more of this kind of stuff we go through, our projections. And as we do this more and more, we start to establish gap, more space. This word gap is very important because, you know, the gap is basically this very open space. And as we learn how to continually open to that gap, it becomes gapless in the sense that that is no longer a gap between solidity or, you know, freezing up again, but actually is just simply the way things are. You're in flow with now. And so that's basically what we would call meditation. The conduct is basically, we're talking about something called view, meditation, conduct, and fruition, which is a very famous quatrain of quartet of the path itself. We start with a view, an overview, which we read about and what the sutras and the tantras talk about. The meditation is actually familiarizing ourselves with the experience that they're discussing. The conduct is learning how to become inseparable. And he starts to introduce this notion of Buddha mind. He calls it Rigpa. And so the word Rigpa is very important. And we have to mention it because it's in the book. And I'm not going to leave myself off the hook about it. But Rigpa is somehow just this experience of direct, open awareness without subject or object. It is simply awareness itself. And awareness does not belong to anybody. It is the nature of our experience, the underlying nature of our experience. And what we call our alaya, we've talked about the alaya before, the alaya vijnana, that's this kind of like substrate of our unconscious mind. It's where all of our gossip and our all of our little programs and our hurts and our hopes and fears and all these other issues, our karma running around, there's a deeper strata to that. And that strata is much more subtle. That's really our home base. And that's where we're going to find Rigpa. So as we get more spacious and give ourselves more room and trust that openness, which is basically free and freeing, because it frees us from all of these kind of knots that we're tied up in, then we can begin to open up and actually recognize what's here already is just basically what we call Rigpa. Ma Rigpa is the opposite. Ma Rigpa means, so Rigpa means awareness or knowing, and Ma Rigpa means not knowing or ignorance. The Ma Rigpa, the ignorance, is the fundamental problem. It's the clouding over. But the Rigpa, in this sense, as knowing, is not sort of the dualistic kind where I've read 10,000 books and I understand, I've memorized and all these concepts and everything. This is a knowing that's a state of being.
How would you compare that to prajna?
Okay, so this is a very important point. They're both translated as wisdom in one sense or other. But Rigpa specifically is awareness, like this fundamental torch that you could say is connected with our basic essence. Prajna is basically this, it's called wisdom, it is also a faculty of the mind or a capacity to discern the truth of phenomena. It's capable of seeing the truth about emptiness. When we actually are open to this openness, open space, when we are actually able to actually just simply be open to non-concept, non-thought, and actually be there in awareness, that's fundamentally what the fruit of this practice, the Prajnaparamita, is to discern. That's why it's the summit of the crown of all the other
practices. To discern what?
Discern the basic nature, the basic truth of what we're doing here, of what the situation is, of the nature of our mind. If we don't understand the nature of our mind, we cannot understand the nature of phenomena. Does that make sense? It's not like phenomena is already there for us to understand and somehow mind doesn't need to be known. It's not just like mind is some kind of recording machine that, you know, sort of gets implanted or imposed with all of these, encoded with all these phenomenal kind of existence, as it were. Our mind is creating the experience we have. And so our mind is what needs to be known as a priority. And the prajna is going to help us understand the nature of mind, because it actually sees the empty nature of our mind. If we see the empty nature of our mind, then it's going to be much easier to see the nature of phenomena. But I think it has to come in that sequence. I mean, we can have moments of flash of openness, and you know, that's great. But, you know, it doesn't mean that the understanding is there. And the understanding comes with the familiarization and the practice and the path. So I know we need to get on with the other business of looking at the...
We haven't gone beyond that.
We have to get beyond
that. Well, we're going to. We're going straight into, basically, the mantra. And now, why is it that we have this mantra? What is a mantra? What does it do? The word mantra is a combination of two fundamental root words in Sanskrit. Man means manas, which is mind. Tra, or has many different meanings, but it's fundamentally protective. So one of the words in Sanskrit is called tramen, and that's a protector. It's like an element to it, or a being, or an aspect which fundamentally establishes a protection. And this mantra is the means by which we make this leap into using the prajna to be able to discern the nature of reality, the fundamental truth, the nature of our mind. So we need to understand that when we talk about this, that we're not just coming in here with some kind of cold kind of you know, laser beam that's going to go in there, or it's not like turning on a computer and just looking at all this flat surface stuff that's basically cold. It's actually, it's all about fundamentally warmth and openness, because this emptiness and compassion have to be understood as fundamentally inseparable if we want to ever learn what awake really means. Okay? Awake is not just having an alarm call off and go, oh, okay. it's actually something that's much more of a continuity. And it's the basis. So we have to be really friends with ourselves to see this, and friends with our experience. We have to be able to view the universe as fundamentally friendly. We start by Maitri. We've discussed Maitri in our earlier classes. Maitri is fundamentally making friends with ourselves, so that we can extend that further in terms of being able to establish a friendly relationship with our experience.
How does friendly have to do with prajna, or seeing through something?
Well, without this state of friendliness, we're going to be at odds with at a constant state. The friendliness allows us to get more open. Openness occurs in stages, in terms of a real kind of sense of engagement and the path. So we have to make friends with ourselves if we're going to actually look at the nature of our mind. Mm-hmm. If we're going to go to war with it, then, you know, we're going to get shut off.
And then
we're
not there's no trust. There's no trust that you're...
That's right. Exactly. So Maitri establishes a fundamental sense of trust that allows us to deepen. And then this Maitri leads us to a softer sense of tenderness and openness. And this tender heart thing is really important. so that we begin to understand that compassion is not just, you know, gushing or, you know, being a good person and feeling good about everybody. It's really about a willingness to be totally responsive naturally to the situation, any situation that arises, and a total openness from the heart. Again, we've talked again and again about how heart here, this is where mind is in the Buddhist terminology. Mind is here.
In
this
heart.
Brain. That's brain, but this is mind. Because this is a much vaster kind of domain. Okay, the mind is a servant. The brain, what we call the brain, and its cognitive capacities are part of it. Fundamentally structured to serve the greater dimensions of mind. Otherwise, it can't, because it cannot deal with non-conceptuality. This deals with concepts. We're talking about going beyond concepts.
I think it's important to remind ourselves again that Maitri also includes, you include us, yourself, in the compassion, in that tenderness, that
right.
Actually, you have to begin with yourself, or else you're just putting a Band-Aid on. You're being a really nice person. Yeah. And we're talking about something much more.
So there are three doors to liberation, called three doors to liberation. And that means, I'll just tell you what they are, and then we'll go into it for just moments. One is that things are signless. It's beyond concept or symbol. Even though our mind uses symbols, and that's fine, we're not trying to get rid of them, but the liberation itself is beyond signs. It's also desireless.
I read it, and I think, what does sign mean? Like, what?
That's a great question.
Well, the way he describes it, he says it's not practiced with the body. So it's beyond a reference point. Again, signless is beyond reference. Does that make sense? We've been talking about abandoning or willing to give up reference points to just be present unconditionally. Mm-hmm. That's, we could say right now that in a very real way, signlessness is basically, what did I just say? Because I just had it.
Non-reference point.
Non-reference, yes.
Yeah. Give up. Something.
Give up, totally open, right? And, you know, and so they basically, there's no grasping. Nothing to grasp onto with the mind. Desireless is very important. You know, this word desire, it penetrates everything that we're involved with. But fundamentally, liberation, the real liberation, the real freedom is beyond desire. Does this make sense?
But we're in the desire realm, aren't we?
When we are in the throes of desire, we are not free. We are entrapped by our desires. This is why the desire realm is fundamentally a challenge. Being in the desire realm means we have a body, for one thing. You know, and you don't get rid of your desires. You have to eat, you have to take care of yourself, you have to do things, and you have to live properly. And you use desires. But the question is, who's in the driver's seat, as it were? Who's in charge of this? Are your desires in charge of your life, or are you able to manage your desires? And desirelessness is a willingness to step out of desire and experience that openness, which is not, doesn't need any embellishment, anything to better itself. Mm-hmm. When we talk about something much further down the road here in terms of the path called great completion or great perfection, and that's what it's about. It's just basically completely perfect. Everything is fundamentally self-perfected as it is in this openness. This openness, and this is why it's such a tragedy, why our lives are such, we're on such the edge of a tragedy all the time, is because we don't open ourselves to this innate perfection, which is fundamental to this state of openness, emptiness. This is the real treasure that we find. But, of course, we have to let go of desire to be able to experience that.
It's hard, though. That's really hard.
Well, So, you know, I don't want to... Okay, I've got to get on this other thing about just finally saying the mantra.
Get to the mantra.
Okay, so... Om.
Om.
Om is a word probably people have heard who have ever heard mantras. It doesn't mean anything in itself. but it tends to be having it has almost a cleansing quality to itself of just sort of moving stuff out of the way in terms of open space, Om. So Om precedes the actual mantra. But the mantra is basically itself going to be a key to understanding what we're talking about here, what we're understanding about actually experiencing emptiness, and we're experiencing fundamental nature of reality, experiencing the nature of our minds. So the first word is gate, gate. And he mentions it here as fundamentally, this means gone, meaning gone. What is gone? Obstacles are gone. We are going to basically use this mantra to dispel obstacles, to weaken their power over us. Particularly the obstacles are desire, because we're constantly being entrapped by desire in our habitual patterns, in our neuroses, which we find very comfortable and reassuring, and our coziness about being me and my little corner. We're learning how to basically dispel that, let go of it, release it. It's a creation of pain. This is, we're going to define the nature of suffering here when we talk about these obstacles and shackles. So we're dispelling obstacles. And he mentions this word abhisheka, which is, an abhisheka is a Sanskrit word for something like an initiation. It's a situation where you're empowered to actually enter a deeper level of truth. And there's a thing called sprinkling, which is water, sprinkling or a liquid, and that's meant in this case to simply indicate the cleansing nature of wisdom itself, that we're going to be cleared and cleansed with wisdom mind. And these are blessings that come from in the innate wisdom. By doing these practices, we're actually invoking the innate wisdom that is the Buddha mind. Paragate is going beyond. It's going to the other shore, beyond samsara. It's going beyond. It's what we train in. We're training in going beyond this space of constant reference points. We're moving into a space of non-reference point with prajna, using prajna to... And basically, through prajna, we create bodhicitta, an open heart, and we basically give rise to compassion, very naturally, and the six paramitas. So this leads to something called the illusion-like samadhi, which means we begin to sort of see the truth about appearance. And we actually settle our minds. To do this, we have to be very subtle. We have to be really calm. We can't be carrying around a huge load of emotional turmoil. So all that stuff is being dropped. And that's the process of dropping and continuing to realize that our true nature is beyond this kind of confusion. But we are working with confusion. So don't forget, we're not just trying to get rid of confusion. But we need to understand how to cut through seeing nothing but confusion, so that we can start to see wisdom in basically the nature of confusion itself. That's where it ultimately gets revealed. Parasangate is arriving at, as it were, non-abiding. Okay, handle that. Non-abiding nirvana. So now this is basically fundamentally just a simple state of indestructible or imperturbable peace. That there's a basic ground we have within us, a ground level, which is not having any problem with anything.
That's nice.
Sorry. Yes, it is.
Okay.
That's
nice.
All right. So at that point, what we call our three gates,
cutting through this,
our body, speech, and mind, are perfected in simplicity. Because we are ultimately aligned with reality itself and the nature of our own basic essential mind, essential nature. So then we have this exclamation or proclamation, Bodhi. Bodhi is basically perfect realization. Buddha itself, Bodhi means Bodh, B-O-D-H, is awake. And the word Buddha comes from the word Bodh, So Buddha is an awakened one, someone who has awakened. Awakened to the true nature, awakened to the true fundamental reality, and awakened to the freedom or the liberation which comes from knowing the mind. And he also mentions the four karmas. So basically when Buddhas do anything, Buddha activity, as it were, are related to pacifying, enriching, magnetizing, and destroying. We don't have a lot of time to go into those details right now, but if we want to, it's important. That's, he mentions it. I just want to make sure you understand. Yeah. He said, and these are called the four karmas. If we ever go further on this path with regard to going into some Vajrayana such teachings, then we'll discuss that further, but we can at least touch on it later when we have more time.
What are the four again?
Pacifying, enriching, magnetizing, and destroying or subjugating. These relate to the five skandhas, four of the five skandhas, actually. So it has to do, because each of the skandhas manifest, start to manifest as wisdom at this point. The form skandha, which is basically, we talked about form, right? Fundamental, everything starts coming out of form skandha. That's where all the flickering and all the nervousness, anxiety, and everything else, and the grasping starts to turn. The fundamental anxiety, that turns into mirror-like wisdom. Feeling, which is the second skandha, and the notion of basically accepting and rejecting, because everything is either positive, negative, or neutral. Feeling, sensation, you know, that becomes enriching wisdom. It's basically it's symbolized by each one of these has a Buddha, etc., Ratnasambhava. It's actually equanimity, the wisdom of equanimity, so that instead of polarizing ourselves in this yes, no, maybe, and all this the indifference, we're actually working with a complete openness to equanimity. This is one of the four Brahma-viharas.
By the way, this was covered two lectures ago.
Oh, what? Well, yeah. It's here.
Okay.
We're just.
It's okay. Never heard.
I mean, if everybody knows this already, I'll stop.
No,
I'm okay.
It wasn't covered. That's okay. It's not a problem.
We are trying to understand how this works, the third one, perception, is basically discrimination. Discriminating awareness wisdom. The fourth one, karma, which is usually typified by envy as neurosis, becomes all accomplishing wisdom. Fourth skandha, of course, is where all of the mechanisms of mind are found. And the fifth one is consciousness, which is fundamentally dharma-dhatu wisdom. That's much more inconceivable, but that's where all of the surface stuff is.
Can you have different levels of inconceivable? It would seem like a yes or no.
Our little thing that makes our world hinge together, you know, I'm me, and this is always continually me, instead of realizing we're just a series of little moments, like a flicks on, chips on a film, that is, you know, the strip that's going on and on, is basically cut through. And we're experiencing complete openness and the basic primordial ground.
I have to say something funny here.
Okay.
Even though there's not much time left. But okay, so right near Brandeis, where we go to lifelong learning, there's a business called Aggregate Industries. And basically they take all these pieces of stone, put them together and make concrete. So if you want to remember what the five skandhas are, you can think of the aggregates and this little, the concrete mixer. Yeah, all those pieces come together.
Oh, yeah, that's a fifth skandha.
What's that?
So the skandhas are all just at the bottom of the hill there.
Well, they're in a big rock pile. They're right next to Brandeis.
They're down the hill from me.
Oh, well, that's true. Well, that's your perspective. There you go.
So the last word is swaha. Swaha is like saying this is it, or amen in Western parlance. It's basically an exclamation or declaration, and it says so it is, so be it. And so we're saying Bodhi, awakened mind, that's it. Gate, Om Gate, Gate, Paragate, Parasangate, Bodhi, Swaha. Do we have time for questions or discussion?
Good, good, Asana.
Good, good.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Erica.
Two questions. Could you discuss, one, why it's mind protection to say the mantra?
So there's, it has a twofold aspect to it. One is that we are actually replacing our continuous chatter with a sound which, you know, has, you don't have to buy into it, but it's called sacred. And when you get into Vajrayana, it is sacred, and it's considered secret because it carries the power of wisdom in the mantra itself. Secret meaning you either have to experience it to know it, and either you're doing it or you're not. You're not going to theorize outside of it and figure out whether it's true or not. You only can know by experiencing it directly. So that's what meaning secret is in this particular case. There's other levels of secret, but this is the most important.
This is Buddhism.
And then the second component is basically simply that you know, you're learning how to commit yourself more and more to what we're getting at, which is the essence. We're actually directing our mind when we say this mantra to that essence and compassion, and we're doing that again and again, so that we're not just saying, "Ah, okay, fine, now back to thought," you know. We're actually keeping our focus, or our general focus, not, and it's a light focus, not heavy duty. But we're actually continually directing our energy toward that dimension. And it's easy. You know, it's like it's not having, you don't have to struggle doing this. So what this means is that this is a mode of familiarization. We still have to practice meditation. This is not a substitute, but it helps. When we're off the cushion, it definitely helps to establish some sense of continuity.
So are you saying we could recite this?
We could.
Any time during the day?
Any time during the day. It's actually a very good way to check in. You know, I know I've heard all these teachings. I'm interested. I'd like to be able to do something with that. And now I'm feeling like a piece of shit because I just, you know, chopped my finger on the knife. You know, what do I do now? I'm bleeding, you know, like, ah! You know, and the phone's ringing, you know, and, you know, I got to take a crap. You want to build it? Well, gate. You know, I'll work with it.
Why is that more powerful than any of the other techniques that we've been studying? Is there something, you know, it seems like there's an awful lot of things in one's toolbox already.
Well, this is the pith. It summarizes, if we study the meaning of that mantra, and actually it's more important we experience the mantra itself, that we begin to see it's kind of like the way to hope to basically return to that focus.
It's like a laser beam.
We don't have time to, you know, we don't have time to just sit down and go, wait a minute, what was on page 66, and, you know, how do I relate to that in terms of where I am now? I mean, that's a different kind of use of the mind. This is a direct use of the mind to use our actual form, using the term of using speech to build a relationship to the teachings. We have chants in Buddhism, and sometimes people think, well, why do you guys do these chants? You know, like we're reciting one chant after the other, and then you could spend about half an hour a day, or more, a lot more if you want, doing chants. One of the reasons why is because it helps us build an actual, through the vocalization, it helps us build a relationship between our vibrancy and connectivity to the teachings, using our body with our speech. So, I mean, I personally found this to be the case. I started memorizing, just doing the text every day, and then I memorized them fairly quickly, and these chants would be very helpful to just get my day going, you know? I mean, I could sort of stay with the teachings of where I wanted to be, and then as we go further, you know, we will go further. But right now, this is the first mantra you're being introduced to, and this is a really essential one. I mean, in fact, this is probably, if there's any one single mantra that's of real importance, because without this kind of passage, without getting this understanding of the Prajnaparamita, of getting the understanding of wisdom and compassion, fundamentally in terms of emptiness itself, and the nature of reality, you know, we can't go any further. We're not going to be able to move beyond. There are other dimensions to go to explore, other levels to explore, once we are willing to actually fundamentally align ourselves in this. And that's why it's kind of a gateway to these higher we call them the higher yanas.
So are you talking about Vajrayana now? That when you talk about the going beyond, the haga, you know, or are you talking about, I mean, I know that the book said that the mantra is typical of Vajrayana.
Yes, but I don't think it's only pertaining to Vajrayana alone, because if we look at the Bodhisattva Jnana, we have these bhumis. We have 10 bhumis, at least. I mean, 10 that are talked about in most books. There's actually 13 when you get more involved, but right now it's enough.
Sheila can't wait.
10 bhumis, and how are we going to get on these bhumis? I mean, how do you practice? We're talking about how to practice with establishing ourselves and understanding, ascertaining for ourselves the nature of mind. And so that's the first bhumi, is recognizing emptiness. That's the and that's the first bhumi that's called the. I don't want to get too. I'm not going to go deep.
Okay.
And then we have another 10 levels of the Bodhisattva bhumis. But those are all going to be working with penetrating this deeper dimension of emptiness and wisdom.
So I don't know how many of you have seen that movie that we show called Enlightenment Guaranteed.
That was great.
Yeah. And maybe you'll have a chance to see it again. But
I do actually. We have a copy if you want to borrow it.
I missed it, actually. I wouldn't mind seeing it.
But you will see that there are practices where just the mantra alone is recited over and over and over again. We have experienced it with Kirtan Rinpoche's retreat. It's in that movie and occurs many other places.
Oh, Anam Tipton.
Anam Tipton does the Prajnapara.
He does that, yeah. He
sings it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so it can be sung, and it can be sung again and again and again, just the mantra, not the whole sutra. And that is a very traditional thing to do.
And the mantra is supposed to codify and be the essence of the entire sutra. And there is a lot of Prajnaparamita sutras. This is just one. There are many. But still, this is the essence mantra for all of them. So, you know, this is why it's helpful, because we have a key to opening ourselves up, utilizing our mind to actually stabilize and focus on this experience. And as we familiarize it, it's no longer something exotic or outside of ourselves. We begin to realize, yes, you know, part of my life. And it makes my life much more livable and bearable, frankly. So.
Okay.
So, good. Good.
Thank you very much. Please, now, the thing we should do is try to understand, we want to be able to continue this conversation in our subsequent classes and our engagements with each other. I think part of what we do as a Sangha, why we can be of help to each other, is to actually explore this material. So it's not just ending with this particular class, this particular topic, as it were. Okay? And I invite everyone to continue working with this, and we are available to talk about it and explore it together further if you want.
Okay.